So imagine for a second that you want to expose a really harsh, unforgiving economic system.
Okay, yeah.
Like that grinding, relentless struggle that working class folks, specifically Latino micro entrepreneurs here in the US, face every single day. If you had to paint that struggle for an audience, what would it look like?
Well, I mean, you'd probably expect something right out of the classic muralism playbook, right?
Exactly.
You'd want something gritty, visceral, like faces marked by exhaustion and sweat, or the hard concrete of the street.
Right. You expect this direct visual protest. You want art that acts like a hammer, basically, just demanding immediate outrage from you. But the artist Charles Duke, he decided to just ignore those expectations completely.
Totally threw them out the window.
So in his June 2024 painting called Mercado in Santa Monica, so Santa Monica Market, he took this incredibly grueling story of economic survival and he bathed it in this dazzling, peaceful Southern California light.
Which is such a wild pivot.
It really is. And he didn't paint it in some massive industrial warehouse either. He did it in his small home studio in Whittier, California, using fluid, just luminous watercolors,
Right.
which leaves us with a really difficult question to explore on today's deep dive. Okay, let's unpack this. Does making a struggle beautiful actually elevate it for a global audience? Or does it, accidentally erase the very pain it's trying to highlight?
It creates such a fascinating paradox for you as the viewer, honestly, because we are so conditioned to expect this aesthetic of conflict when we're dealing with social commentary.
Oh, absolutely.
So when we see pure unfiltered beauty instead, we almost get a little suspicious, like we're looking for those hard edges and explicit
They
drama.
want the grit.
Exactly. And to really grasp why Duke chose this route, we have to look at the genesis of the image itself. Because this wasn't just painted from imagination. It was based on a photograph he actually took in Santa Monica, focusing on one very specific stand in a traveling pop-up market.
And here is where the narrative takes this incredible, just emotional turn. It totally changes how you view the entire piece.
Oh, yeah, it really does.
The stand he photographed is called Beso del Sol Boutique. And the vendors working under that tent, they aren't strangers, do just happen to walk past.
No, not at all.
They are his own family. The people running this boutique are his daughter, Valentina, and her husband, Catlin.
That intimate connection just fundamentally changes the stakes of the painting. I mean, it's no longer just an observation of the working class. It's a literal documentation of his own family's livelihood.
They're the ones physically designing and creating the silver jewelry, the accessories, the clothing. It's this whole family operation. Even Duke's wife, Ruby, acts as this crucial filter for the fashion elements they sell.
And if we, connect this to the bigger macroeconomic picture, this family ecosystem is fighting a massive battle.
A huge one.
They're locked in a classic David and Goliath scenario. Think about the mechanics of the modern retail economy, right?
It's brutal.
On one side, you have the top-down, incredibly cold scale of corporate fast fashion. These are these algorithmic supply chains that can spot a jewelry trend on social media on a Monday and then have like 10,000 cheap knockoffs shipped to you by Friday.
Exactly. Manufactured overseas, mass produced at your door by Friday.
Which is something you, listening to this, have probably encountered. Like when you're scrolling through an app and you see a silver-colored ring being sold for $4, you are interacting with the exact Goliath that Valentine and Catlin are up
And
against.
that corporate machine, it drives down the perceived value of handmade goods. It trains the consumer to just expect immediate gratification at rock bottom prices.
Completely obscuring all the human labor involved.
Precisely. So against that massive invisible force, you have this one family. They represent a local organic network of human encounters.
Yeah.
They were designing by hand, trying to survive and carve out this tangible space in an increasingly digitized, automated economy.
And there's this beautifully poetic parallel happening here, too, that I love from the sources. Oh, the light analogy.
Yes, you have Valentina and Catlin out on the street physically polishing silver so that it catches and reflects the bright Santa Monica sun. It's very tactile, slow, deliberate work.
Right.
And meanwhile, Duke is back in his Whittier studio using the blank white of heavy watercolor paper to capture that exact same light. The whole family is engaged in this intertwined ecosystem of art and commerce.
Pushing back against a system that wants them to just be, passive consumers.
Exactly. They are all molding light to make a living in their own ways.
It's a really powerful realization of shared creative resistance.
Yeah.
But, and this is where it gets complicated, this brings us to the core controversy of the painting's actual execution.
Okay, yeah, let's get into this.
Knowing that these figures are his daughter, his son-in-law, his wife, the most basic human instinct for a painter would be to give us an intimate, hyper-detailed portrait, right?
You'd think so, yeah.
You'd want to capture the specific, recognizable expression of your daughter as she sells her art. You want to highlight her individual effort.
But he does the exact opposite. He uses this radical economy of detail. He literally blurs out his own family's faces, turning them into these anonymous silhouettes.
Which seems so counterintuitive. I mean, why erase the identities of the people you love most when you're trying to document their struggle?
Well, think about looking at traffic on a GPS app, like Google Maps.
Okay.
And if you zoom all the way in on a single driver's face in one specific car, you see their individual frustration, sure, but you completely lose sight of the massive miles-long traffic jam they are stuck in.
You lose the context of the whole system.
Exactly. The individual narrative kind of overshadows the structural reality.
Right.
So by blurring his family's specific features, Duke is intentionally zooming out. He doesn't want you to just see Valentina and Catelyn running a nice weekend hobby stand. He wants you to see the entire engine of the Latino migrant economy.
He's taking the invisibility that society often forces onto working class Latino entrepreneurs and turning it into a symbol of collective presence.
Yes. It's not just one family. It's an archetype of the whole gear that keeps the local economy running.
That is the intended logic of the abstraction, definitely, and it is a powerful way to monumentalize the workforce. However, what's fascinating here is the potential cost of that zoom out.
The danger of abstraction.
Yeah, there is a real tangible danger there.
You mean the risk of it backfiring on the message?
Precisely. We have to ask what gets lost when you strip away those specific human features. When you remove their faces and turn them into smooth, colorful shapes, you risk turning his family into anonymous, well, urban furniture.
Urban furniture, that's a striking way to put it.
They become compositional elements, you know?
Yeah.
Serving the same visual purpose as the palm trees swaying in the background or the sharp angles of the market tents.
They just become aesthetic shapes in the landscape.
Right. And by erasing their individuality, the artist might accidentally erase the brutal resilience required to overcome their specific obstacles.
Oh, that makes sense.
Let's think about the actual physical reality of running a pop-up market stall. We are talking about navigating complex local permits and paying municipal fees before you even make a single sale.
It's exhausting just thinking about it.
And we're talking about fighting the weather. Have you ever tried to anchor a massive, heavy canopy tent on asphalt when the wind is whipping at 30 miles an hour?
No, and I don't want to.
Or standing on hot concrete for 10 hours straight in the July heat.
Yeah, that is backbreaking, anxious work. It's not some serene Sunday stroll.
So when you reduce those workers to blurry, beautiful silhouettes bathed in watercolor light, you run the risk of pacifying that very real physical friction. The grit of the street is basically replaced by the smoothness of the paint.
But if this blurring is what threatens to erase their struggle, we have to look at why he did it. And surprisingly, from what the sources show, it wasn't just a philosophical choice made in a vacuum.
No, it was very practical.
Yeah, it was a physical choice driven by the specific tools in his studio. The water itself actually dictated the narrative.
The physics of the medium are completely central to understanding this piece.
Mm-hmm.
The technique an artist uses is never neutral. The materials speak just as loudly as the subject matter.
And Duke was working with very specific materials here. He painted this on 640-gram cold-pressed Arches paper using premium Daniel Smith pigments.
Which is intense.
Right. Now, I know cold-pressed paper has a lot of texture, but 640 grams is massive. Standard printer paper is, what, about 80 grams?
Roughly, yeah.
So he's essentially painting on a piece of thick, highly absorbent cardboard.
Honestly, it's even more rugged than that. Think of it as a dense rustic sponge. Because it's cold pressed, the surface isn't smooth at all.
Mm-hmm.
At a microscopic level, the paper is this landscape of pronounced textures. Mm-hmm. It is full of tiny valleys, craters, and mountains.
So it's not like drawing with a pen where the line goes exactly where your hand puts it and just stays there forever.
Not at all. And this is where the chemistry of the Daniel Smith pigments becomes so important. These aren't just standard flat dyes.
They're different.
Very. Many of these top-tier pigments are heavily granulating. They are made from actual ground-up minerals and stones.
Oh, wow.
So when you introduce water and these heavy mineral pigments onto that textured microscopic mountain range of the paper, you give up a significant amount of control to gravity and fluid dynamics.
The paint literally takes on a life of its own.
Exactly. The color travels, the heavier mineral particles sink into the microscopic valleys and settle there, while the lighter pigments float on the water and expand outward in ways the artist really cannot entirely predict.
That's wild.
The medium physically demands that the artist work in wet layers, building transparencies. The water actively pushes the pigment around, blurring hard lines and forcing the creation of this dreamy, hazy atmosphere.
So the physical water on the page is what's dissolving the friction of their daily reality, like the sweat, the exhaustion, the heavy lifting of the tent poles. It all just melts into these beautiful, uncontrollable pigment blooms.
That is the absolute crux of the aesthetic critique here. The medium itself pacifies the scene.
Yeah.
It delivers such a captivating visual delight, just watching how the colors interact and settle, that the structural urgency of the social commentary might just vanish into the ether.
Because the viewer gets distracted.
Right. The viewer becomes mesmerized by the technique rather than confronted by the subject.
What I find so compelling is that Duke himself seems to have wrestled with this exact tension. In his own technical notes for the painting, which, by the way, measures just 15 by 11 inches, he is remarkably vulnerable about this.
He really is.
He admits that during the process, he might have actually been seduced by the pigment.
That kind of intellectual honesty from an artist, especially evaluating their own work, is incredibly rare.
It is. He wrote about analyzing the architecture of the background, studying the vendor's surroundings, and he noted that his intense focus on how the light bounced off the market awnings might have actually overpowered the human figures beneath them.
The setting swallowed the people.
Exactly. The light and the color density started competing with the people. He let the beauty of the ephemeral moment take the reins.
Which brings up a critical question regarding intention versus impact. If the technique takes over, and the artist prioritizes capturing the bounce of light on an awning over establishing the hierarchy of the human figures,
doesn't the social urgency wash away?
Doesn't the painting run the risk of becoming exactly what critics of beautified struggle fear? Like a stunning piece of living room decoration.
Just a pretty picture.
A pretty picture that is completely divorced from the harsh realities of the corporate retail machine it originally set out to critique.
And that tension between a serene, beautiful technique and a harsh economic reality, it really faced its ultimate test when the painting actually left California. It didn't just stay in his studio or get hung up in some local community center.
No, the leap from the local to the global changes the context entirely.
It really does. In July 2024, this small 15 by 11 inch watercolor made a massive geographical jump. It went from capturing a hyper-local, family-run traveling market in Santa Monica to hanging on the walls of the Art Boxes and Priart Gallery in Venice, Italy.
And that international journey is, in many ways, the ultimate proof that the abstraction actually worked.
Wait, how so? How does moving to Europe prove the blur was the right choice?
Think about the alternative scenario. If Duke had painted a hyper-literal, gritty, deeply intimate portrait of Valentina selling her earrings, it might have been perceived by the art world as just too specific, too localized.
Like it wouldn't translate.
Right. It would look like a family snapshot or a highly regional piece of Southern California street documentation. It might never have left the family home. Or at best, it would have stayed within the confines of regional American art shows.
Because international galleries might not see the universal appeal in one specific person's weekend job.
But by synthesizing the image, you know, by blurring the faces and leaning heavily into the universal language of light, color, and abstraction, Duke created a bridge. He allowed a very specific, hyper-local American socioeconomic struggle to be validated on a global stage. The abstraction turned Valentina and Catlin into universal symbols of labor that a gallery curator in Italy could immediately connect with.
Okay, I hear that, but let me push back on that a bit just by looking at the specific location.
Sure.
Venice is a city with its own intense baggage, right? It is absolutely saturated by blinding light reflecting off the canals, and it is completely crushed by mass tourism.
Oh, heavily crushed.
So when this painting is hanging in a Venetian gallery, what are those specific viewers actually consuming? When wealthy international collectors or European tourists stroll through that space and stop in front of Mercado in Santa Monica, are they really decoding the harsh realities of American micro-entrepreneurs fighting algorithmic fast fashion?
You're asking if the core message actually survives the translation across cultures and quite frankly, tax bracket.
Exactly. Are they looking at those blurred, faithless figures and thinking about the complex, tactile design process of Beso del Sol Boutique?
Probably not.
Are they considering the grueling resilience required to navigate municipal permits? Or are they just looking at a brilliantly composed, rhythmic, diagonal watercolor that just happens to feature some nice shapes?
Well, some art theorists argue that this Bewley acts as a Trojan horse.
A Trojan horse.
Yeah, that Duke uses what he poetically calls the silence of the paper, you know, the blank, unpainted white spaces, to lure the viewer in with aesthetic pleasure. And then, once their defenses are down, the persistence and humanity of these laborers slips into their subconscious.
I mean, that sounds nice in theory.
The Trojan horse theory relies on human psychology. If you paint a dark, hyper-realistic, dramatic scene of poverty and struggle, the average gallery viewer, especially a tourist relaxing in a sunny locale like Venice, will instinctively put up their emotional defenses.
I'll just walk past it.
Right. They'll reject the art as being too preachy, too pamphlet-like, or simply too depressing for a leisure activity.
But my fear is whether the conduct is just too soft, you know? If the physical water on that heavy arches paper has literally washed away the sweat and the exhaustion, the viewer walks through that Trojan horse door and just finds themselves in a very comfortable, beautifully lit room.
They miss the struggle entirely.
Yeah. They don't feel the heat of the asphalt radiating through their shoes. They don't feel the frustration of a windstorm threatening to tear down the inventory. The message doesn't slip past their defenses. It just gets ignored because the atmosphere of the painting is too serene to demand action.
That is the incredibly fine tightrope Duke is walking here. And honestly, it's a tightrope every single artist attempting social commentary has to navigate.
The tough balance.
Do you alienate your audience with the ugly truth? Or do you pacify them with a beautiful lie? But perhaps the true irony of social representation lies right here sometimes. To make a global society actually look at the workers that the economic system has made invisible, the artist has to paint them without faces.
Wow. To make them visible, you have to erase their defining features.
Exactly. By refusing to give the viewer a rigid photographic record of his family's specific Sunday morning, he monumentalizes them.
He makes them bigger than the moment.
The white of that heavy arches paper doesn't hide their effort, it elevates it. It turns the mundane act of selling handmade silver jewelry under a pop-up tent into a profound form of poetic resistance.
Yeah.
It says that their labor is worthy of the exact same high art treatment as a Renaissance landscape or a classical portrait.
It is genuinely fascinating how a weekend jewelry stall run by a family in California became this international case study on how we choose to represent labor, resilience, and the corporate squeeze.
Quite a journey.
We've gone from tracing the microscopic valleys of cold-pressed watercolor paper in a small Whittier studio to exploring the grand galleries of Venice, Italy. It really forces you to respect Duke's bravery. He took a massive emotional risk in leaving his own family faceless, just to ensure their broader struggle was universally seen.
It is a testament to a creator who is deeply aware of the boundary between a bold social declaration and atmospheric seduction.
Definitely.
He didn't just paint on autopilot. He wrestled with the physics of the medium, the structural realities of the economy, and his own family's livelihood. He let that tension live on the paper.
And it leaves you, listening to this, with a final thought to mull over the next time you look at a beautiful piece of art, or even the next time you just walk past a local vendor's tent on the street.
Right.
If beautiful art makes a harsh, grueling reality easier for the general public to consume, who is that comfort actually serving? Is it serving the workers who lived and breathed that struggle every single weekend? Or is it serving the viewer who gets the privilege of hanging a beautifully pacified version of that struggle on their living room wall without ever having to feel the heat of the concrete?
That's the real question.
We started today by talking about how social protest usually requires a visual hammer. But maybe we need to ask if a watercolor, with its quiet, creeping blooms of pigment, can leave a dent that lasts even longer.
A question that certainly doesn't have an easy answer, but one that changes how we consume both art and the world around us.
Absolutely. And it's exactly why we love taking these deep dives. Until next time.